It is not only futile, but positively baneful to aspire to them. Some critics unfairly tried to lump the pluralistic impulses of multiculturalism together with the arguments of radical postmodernists who mocked the very possibility of teaching or writing history fairly. The former offered a crucial antidote to traditional narratives of American exceptionalism and Western triumphalism by opening the once narrow gates of history to the voices of women, African Americans, Native Americans, immigrants, and other heretofore marginalized points of view. Multiculturalism underscored the incompleteness of much history writing, as Joyce Appleby, Lynn Hunt, and Margaret Jacob argued in their incisive and common sense-filled book, Telling the Truth About History, and offered the possibility of a more inclusive, more choral perspective. But they also warned that extreme views could lead to the dangerously reductive belief that knowledge about the past is simply an ideological construction intended to serve particular interests, making history a series of myths establishing or reinforcing group identities. Science, too, came under attack by radical postmodernists who argued that scientific theories are socially constructed. They are informed by the identity of the person positing the theory and the values of the culture in which they are formed. Therefore, science cannot possibly make claims to neutrality or universal truths. The postmodern view fit well with the ambivalence toward science that developed after the bomb and during the Cold War, Sean Otto wrote in The War on Science. Among left-leaning academics in the humanities departments of universities, he went on, science came to be seen as the province of a hawkish, pro-business, right-wing power structure, polluting, uncaring, greedy, mechanistic, sexist, racist, imperialist, homophobic, oppressive, intolerant. A heartless ideology that cared little for the spiritual or holistic wellness of our souls, our bodies, or our Mother Earth. It was ridiculous, of course, to argue that a researcher's cultural background could affect verifiable scientific facts. As Otto succinctly put it, atmospheric CO2 is the same whether the scientist measuring it is a Somali woman or an Argentine man. But such postmodernist arguments would clear the way for today's anti-vaxxers and global warming deniers, who refuse to accept the consensus opinion of the overwhelming majority of scientists. As on so many other subjects, Orwell saw the perils of this sort of thinking decades ago. In a 1943 essay, he wrote, "What is peculiar to our own age is the abandonment of the idea that history could be truthfully written. In the past, people deliberately lied, or they unconsciously colored what they wrote, or they struggled after the truth, well knowing that they must make many mistakes. But in each case, they believed that facts existed and were more or less discoverable. It is just this common basis of agreement," he went on, "with its implication that human beings are all one species of animal, that totalitarianism destroys. Nazi theory indeed specifically denies that such a thing as the truth exists. There is, for instance, no such thing as science. There is only German science, Jewish science, etc. When truth is so fragmented, so relative," Orwell noted, "a path is opened for some leader or some ruling clique to dictate what is to be believed. If the leader says of such and such an event it never happened, well, it never happened." People trying to win respectability for clearly discredited theories, or in the case of Holocaust revisionists trying to whitewash entire chapters of history, exploited the postmodernist argument that all truths are partial. Deconstructionist history, the scholar Deborah E. Lipstadt observed in Denying the Holocaust, has the potential to alter dramatically the way established truth is transmitted from generation to generation. And it can foster an intellectual climate in which no fact, no event, and no aspect of history has any fixed meaning or content. Any truth can be retold. Any fact can be recast. There is no ultimate historical reality. Postmodernism not only rejected all meta-narratives, but also emphasized the instability of language. One of postmodernism's founding fathers, Jacques Derrida, who would achieve celebrity status on American campuses in the 1970s and 1980s, thanks in large part to such disciples as Paul de Man and J. Hillis Miller, used the word deconstruction to describe the sort of textual analysis he pioneered that would be applied not just to literature, but to history, architecture, and the social sciences as well. Deconstruction posited that all texts are unstable and irreducibly complex, and that ever-variable meanings are imputed by readers and observers. In focusing on the possible contradictions and ambiguities of a text, and articulating such arguments in deliberately tangled and pretentious prose, it promulgated an extreme relativism that was ultimately nihilistic in its implications. Anything could mean anything. An author's intent did not matter, could not in fact be discerned. There was no such thing as an obvious or common sense reading, because everything had an infinitude of meanings. In short, there was no such thing as truth. As David Lehman recounted in his astute book Signs of the Times, the worst suspicions of critics of deconstruction were confirmed when the Paul de Man scandal exploded in 1987 and deconstructionist rationales were advanced to defend the indefensible. De Man, a professor at Yale and one of deconstruction's brightest stars, had achieved an almost cult-like following in academic circles. Students and colleagues described him as a brilliant, charismatic, and charming scholar who had fled Nazi Europe, where, he implied, he had been a member of the Belgian resistance. A very different portrait would emerge from Evelyn Barish's biography, The Double Life of Paul de Man. An unrepentant con man, an opportunist, bigamist, and toxic narcissist who'd been convicted in Belgium of fraud, forgery, and falsifying records. The most shocking news had been revealed in 1987, 4 years after his death. A young Belgian researcher discovered that de Man had written at least 100 articles for a pro-Nazi Belgian publication, Le Soir, during World War II, a publication that espoused a virulent anti-Semitism, declaring in one editorial that "we are determined to forbid ourselves any crossbreeding with them and to liberate ourselves spiritually from their demoralizing influence in the realm of thought, literature, and the arts." In the most notorious of his Le Soir articles, de Man argued that Jewish writers have always remained in the second rank and had therefore failed to exercise a preponderant influence on the evolution of contemporary European civilization. "One can thus see," he wrote, "that a solution to the Jewish problem that would lead to the creation of a Jewish colony isolated from Europe would not have, for the literary life of the West, regrettable consequences. It would lose, in all, some personalities of mediocre worth, and would continue, as in the past, to develop according to its higher laws of evolution." As news of de Man's alarming collaborationist writings swept through academia, some scholars wondered if de Man's shameful and secret past had informed his theories about deconstruction. For instance, his contention that considerations of the actual and historical existence of writers are a waste of time. More disturbing still were efforts by some of de Man's defenders, like Derrida, to use the principles of deconstruction to try to explain away de Man's anti-Semitic writings, suggesting that his words actually subverted what they appeared to say, or that there was too much ambiguity inherent in his words to assign moral responsibility. One de Man admirer, cited by Lehman, tried to argue that de Man's remarks about Jewish writers were a case of irony misfiring, contending that the essay's tone was one of detached mockery throughout the sections dealing with the Jews, and the object of the mockery is clearly not the Jews, but rather the anti-Semites. In other words, the writer was suggesting that de Man had meant the very opposite of what his Le Soir columns stated. Though deconstructionists are fond of employing jargon-filled prose and perversely acrobatic syntax, some of the terms they use, like the indeterminacy of texts, alternative ways of knowing, and the linguistic instability of language, feel like pretentious versions of phrases recently used by Trump aides to explain away his lies, flip-flops, and bad faith promises. For instance, a Trump representative telling an advisor to the Japanese Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, that they didn't have to take each word that Mr. Trump said publicly, literally. And a former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, asserting that the problem with the media is, you guys took everything Donald Trump said so literally. The American people didn't. 3. Moi and the rise of subjectivity. Our subjectivity is so completely our own. Spike Jones. Parallel with academia's embrace of postmodernism was the blossoming in the 1970s of what Christopher Lash called the culture of narcissism, and what Tom Wolfe memorably termed the me decade, a tidal wave of navel-gazing, self-gratification, and attention-craving that these two authors attributed to very different causes. Lash saw narcissism as a defensive reaction to social change and instability, looking out for number one in a hostile, threatening world. In his 1979 book, The Culture of Narcissism, he argued that a cynical ethic of self-preservation and psychic survival had come to afflict America, a symptom of a country grappling with defeat in Vietnam, a growing mood of pessimism, a mass media culture centered on celebrity and fame, and centrifugal forces that were shrinking the role families played in the transmission of culture. The narcissistic patient who had become increasingly emblematic of this self-absorbed age, Lash wrote, often experienced intense feelings of rage, a sense of inner emptiness, fantasies of omnipotence, and a strong belief in his right to exploit others. Such a patient may be chaotic and impulse-ridden, ravenous for admiration but contemptuous of those he manipulates into providing it, and inclined to conform to social rules more out of fear of punishment than from a sense of guilt. In contrast to Lash, Tom Wolfe saw the explosion of me, me, me in the 1970s as an altogether happier, more hedonistic development, an act of class liberation powered by the post-war economic boom, which had left the working and middle classes with the leisure time and disposable income to pursue the sorts of vain activities once confined to aristocrats, the remaking, remodeling, elevating, and polishing of one's own glorious self. Economic times would grow considerably darker in the 21st century, but the self-absorption that Wolfe and Lash described would remain a lasting feature of Western life, from the me decade of the 1970s on through the selfie age of Kim and Kanye. Social media would further accelerate the ascendance of what the Columbia Law School professor Tim Wu described as the preening self, and the urge to capture the attention of others with the spectacle of oneself. With this embrace of subjectivity came the diminution of objective truth, the celebration of opinion over knowledge, feelings over facts, a development that both reflected and helped foster the rise of Trump. 3 examples. Number 1. Trump, who has been accused of greatly inflating his wealth, was asked about his net worth in a 2007 court deposition. His answer, "It depends. My net worth fluctuates, and it goes up and down with markets and with attitudes and with feelings, even my own feelings." He added that it varied depending on his general attitude at the time that the question may be asked. Number 2. Asked whether he'd questioned Vladimir Putin about Russian interference in the election, Trump replied, "I believe that he feels that he and Russia did not meddle in the election." Number 3. During the Republican National Convention in 2016, the CNN anchor Allison Camerota asked Newt Gingrich about Trump's dark nativist law and order speech, which inaccurately depicted America as a country beset by violence and crime, and she was sharply rebutted by the former Speaker of the House. "I understand your view," Gingrich said. "The current view is that liberals have a whole set of statistics which theoretically may be right, but it's not where human beings are. People are frightened. People feel that their government has abandoned them." Camerota pointed out that the crime statistics weren't liberal numbers. They came from the FBI. The following exchange took place. Gingrich: "No, but what I said is equally true. People feel it." Camerota: "They feel it, yes, but the facts don't support it." Gingrich: "As a political candidate, I'll go with how people feel, and I'll let you go with the theoreticians." The tendency of Americans to focus myopically on their self-pursuits, sometimes to the neglect of their civic responsibilities, is not exactly new. In Democracy in America, written more than a century and a half before people started using Facebook and Instagram to post selfies and the internet was sorting us into silos of like-minded souls, Alexis de Tocqueville noted Americans' tendency to withdraw into small private societies united together by similitude of conditions, habits, and customs in order to indulge themselves in the enjoyments of private life. He worried that this self-absorption would diminish a sense of duty to the larger community, opening the way for a kind of soft despotism on the part of the nation's rulers, power that does not tyrannize but compresses, enervates, extinguishes, and stupefies a people to the point where they are reduced to nothing better than a flock of timid and industrious animals, of which the government is the shepherd. This was one possible cost of a materialistic society, he predicted, where people become so focused on procuring the petty and paltry pleasures with which they glut their lives that they neglect their responsibilities as citizens. It was difficult to conceive, he wrote, how such people who have entirely given up the habit of self-government should succeed in making a proper choice of those by whom they are to be governed. In the mid-20th century, the pursuit of self-fulfillment exploded within both the counterculture and the establishment. Predating Esalen and Est and the encounter groups that attracted hippies and New Age seekers intent on expanding their consciousness in the 1960s and 1970s were two influential figures whose doctrines of self-realization were more materialistic and more attractive to politicians and suburban Rotarians. Norman Vincent Peale, the author of the 1952 self-help bestseller, The Power of Positive Thinking, known as God's Salesman for his hawking of the prosperity gospel, was admired by Trump's father, Fred, and the younger Trump would internalize the celebrity pastor's teachings on self-fulfillment and the power of the mind to create its own reality. Any fact facing us, however difficult, even seemingly hopeless, is not so important as our attitude toward that fact, Peale wrote, seeming to promote the doctrine of denial along with the doctrine of success. A confident and optimistic thought pattern can modify or overcome the fact altogether. Ayn Rand, also admired by Trump, over the years, The Fountainhead is one of the few novels he's cited as a favorite, won the fealty of several generations of politicians, including Paul Ryan, Rand Paul, Ron Paul, and Clarence Thomas, with her transactional view of the world, her equation of success and virtue, and her proud embrace of unfettered capitalism. Her argument that selfishness is a moral imperative, that man's highest moral purpose is the pursuit of his own happiness, would resonate with Trump's own zero-sum view of the world and his untrammeled narcissism. As the West lurched through the cultural upheavals of the 1960s and 1970s and their aftermath, artists struggled with how to depict this fragmenting reality. Some writers like John Barth, Donald Barthelme, and William Gass created self-conscious, postmodernist fictions that put more emphasis on form and language than on conventional storytelling. Others adopted a minimalistic approach, writing pared-down, narrowly focused stories emulating the fierce concision of Raymond Carver. And as the pursuit of broader truths became more and more unfashionable in academia, and as daily life came to feel increasingly unmoored, some writers chose to focus on the smallest, most personal truths. They wrote about themselves. American reality had become so confounding, Philip Roth wrote in a 1961 essay, 1961, that it felt like a kind of embarrassment to one's own meager imagination. This had resulted, he wrote, in the voluntary withdrawal of interest by the writer of fiction from some of the grander social and political phenomena of our times, and the retreat, in his own case, to the more knowable world of the self. In a controversial 1989 essay, Tom Wolfe lamented these developments, mourning what he saw as the demise of old-fashioned realism in American fiction, and he urged novelists to head out into this wild, bizarre, unpredictable, hog-stomping Baroque country of ours and reclaim it as literary property. He tried this himself in novels like The Bonfire of the Vanities and A Man in Full, using his skills as a reporter to help flesh out a spectrum of subcultures with Balzacian detail. But while Wolfe had been an influential advocate in the 1970s of the new journalism, which put a new emphasis on the voice and point of view of the reporter, his new manifesto didn't win that many converts in the literary world. Instead, writers as disparate as Louise Erdrich, David Mitchell, Don DeLillo, Julian Barnes, Chuck Palahniuk, Gillian Flynn, and Lauren Groff would play with devices like multiple points of view, unreliable narrators, and intertwining storylines, pioneered decades ago by innovators like Faulkner, Wolfe, Ford Madox Ford, and Nabokov, to try to capture the new Rashomon-like reality in which subjectivity rules and, in the infamous words of former President Bill Clinton, truth depends on what the meaning of the word is. But what Roth called the sheer fact of self, the vision of self as inviolable, powerful, and nervy, self as the only real thing in an unreal environment, would remain more comfortable territory for many writers. In fact, it would lead, at the turn of the millennium, to a remarkable flowering of memoir writing, including such classics as Mary Carr's The Liar's Club and Dave Eggers' A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, works that established their authors as among the foremost voices of their generation. The memoir boom and the popularity of blogging at the turn of the millennium would eventually culminate in Karl Ove Knausgård's 6-volume autobiographical novel, filled with minutely detailed descriptions drawn from the author's own daily life. Along the way, there were also a lot of self-indulgent, self-dramatizing works by other authors that would have been better left in writers' private journals or social media accounts. The reductio ad absurdum of this navel-gazing was James Frye's best-selling book, A Million Little Pieces, which was sold as a memoir, but which the Smoking Gun website reported in January 2006 contained wholly fabricated or wildly embellished details of his purported criminal career, jail terms, and status as an outlaw wanted in 3 states. Frye, who seems to have engaged in this act of self-dramatization to make himself out to be a more notorious figure than he actually was, presumably so his subsequent redemption would be all the more impressive as an archetypal tale of recovery, later conceded that most of what the Smoking Gun site reported was pretty accurate. For some readers, angry that they had been sold a false bill of goods, Frye's book was a con job, a repudiation of the very qualities, honesty, authenticity, candor, that memoirs are supposed to embody. But other readers shrugged off the differentiation between fact and fiction, their response a symptom of just how comfortable people had become with the blurred lines of truth. Personal testimony also became fashionable on college campuses, as the concept of objective truth fell out of favor and empirical evidence gathered by traditional research came to be regarded with suspicion. Academic writers began prefacing scholarly papers with disquisitions on their own positioning, their race, religion, gender, background, personal experiences that might inform or skew or ratify their analysis. Some proponents of the new moi criticism began writing full-fledged academic autobiographies, Adam Begley reported in Lingua Franca in 1994, noting that the trend toward autobiography traced back to the 1960s, to early feminist consciousness-raising groups, and that it often spread in tandem with multiculturalism. News about minority experience often comes packaged in the first-person singular. Ditto for gay studies and queer theory. In her 1996 book, Dedication to Hunger, The Anorexic Aesthetic in Modern Culture, the scholar Leslie Haywood used events from her own life, like her own anorexia and a humiliating relationship with a married man, to draw analogies between anorexia and modernism, an approach that had the effect of reducing great masterpieces like T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland into case studies in an anti-women, anti-fat aesthetic. Personal stories or agendas started turning up in biographies, too. No longer were biographies simple chronicles of other people's lives. Instead, they became platforms for philosophical manifestos. Norman Mailer's portrait of Picasso as a young man, feminist polemics, Francine Duplessis Gray's Rage and Fire, a portrait of Flaubert's mistress Louise Colet, and deconstructionist exercises, S. Page Beatty's American Monroe, The Making of a Body Politic. Arguably the most preposterous exercise in biographical writing was Dutch, a memoir of Ronald Reagan, a 1999 book by Reagan's official biographer, Edmund Morris, which turned out to be a perplexing ragtime-esque mashup of fact and fantasy, featuring a fictional narrator who is 28 years older than the real Morris and who was supposedly saved from drowning in his youth by the future president. Instead of using his extraordinary access to a sitting president and his personal papers to create a detailed portrait of the 40th president, or to grapple with important issues like Iran-Contra or the end of the Cold War, Morris gave readers cheesy descriptions of his fictional narrator and his fictional family and his fictional or semi-fictional hopes and dreams. Morris took this approach, he explained, because he realized he didn't understand the first thing about his subject, an abdication of the biographer's most basic duty, and because of his own artistic aspirations. "I want to make literature out of Ronald Reagan," he declared. He also described his use of a fictionalized narrator as an advance in biographical honesty, a reminder to the reader of the subjective element involved in all writing. This was an argument that echoed the self-serving reasoning of Janet Malcolm, who suggested in The Silent Woman, her highly partisan 1994 book about Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes, that all biographers share her own disdain for fairness and objectivity, a disingenuous assertion, given that she made no effort to carefully weigh or evaluate material in her book, but instead wrote a kind of long fan letter to Hughes, extolling his literary gifts, his physical attractiveness, his helpless honesty. She wrote about her feeling of tenderness toward Hughes, and how reading one of his letters, she felt her identification with its typing swell into a feeling of intense sympathy and affection for the writer. The postmodernist argument that all truths are partial, and a function of one's perspective, led to the related argument that there are many legitimate ways to understand or represent an event. This both encouraged a more egalitarian discourse and made it possible for the voices of the previously disenfranchised to be heard. But it's also been exploited by those who want to make the case for offensive or debunked theories, or who want to equate things that cannot be equated. Creationists, for instance, called for teaching intelligent design alongside evolution in schools. Teach both, some argued. Others said, teach the controversy. A variation on this both sides argument was employed by President Trump when he tried to equate people demonstrating against white supremacy with the neo-Nazis who had converged in Charlottesville, Virginia, to protest the removal of Confederate statues. There were some very fine people on both sides, Trump declared. He also said, "We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides." Climate deniers, anti-vaxxers, and other groups who don't have science on their side bandy about phrases that wouldn't be out of place in a college class on deconstruction. Phrases like many sides, different perspectives, uncertainties, multiple ways of knowing. As Naomi Oreskes and Eric M. Conway demonstrated in their 2010 book Merchants of Doubt, right-wing think tanks, the fossil fuel industry, and other corporate interests that are intent on discrediting science, be it the reality of climate change or the hazards of asbestos or secondhand smoke or acid rain, have employed a strategy that was first used by the tobacco industry to try to confuse the public about the dangers of smoking. "Doubt is our product," read an infamous memo written by a tobacco industry executive in 1969. "Since it is the best means of competing with the body of fact that exists in the minds of the general public." The strategy, essentially, was this: dig up a handful of so-called professionals to refute established science or argue that more research is needed. Turn these false arguments into talking points and repeat them over and over, and assail the reputations of the genuine scientists on the other side. If this sounds familiar, that's because it's a tactic that's been used by Trump and his Republican allies to defend policies on matters ranging from gun control to building a border wall that run counter to both expert evaluation and national polls. What Oreskes and Conway call the tobacco strategy got an assist, they argued, from elements in the mainstream media that tended to give minority views more credence than they deserve. This false equivalence was the result of journalists confusing balance with truth-telling, willful neutrality with accuracy, caving to pressure from right-wing interest groups to present both sides, and the format of television news shows that feature debates between opposing viewpoints, even when one side represents an overwhelming consensus and the other is an almost complete outlier in the scientific community. For instance, a 2011 BBC Trust report found that the broadcast network's science coverage paid undue attention to marginal opinion on the subject of man-made climate change. Or, as a headline in The Telegraph put it, "BBC staff told to stop inviting cranks on to science programs." In a speech on press freedom, Christiane Amanpour addressed this issue in the context of media coverage of the 2016 presidential race, saying, "Like many people watching where I was overseas, I admit I was shocked by the exceptionally high bar put before one candidate and the exceptionally low bar put before the other candidate. It appeared much of the media got itself into knots trying to differentiate between balance, objectivity, neutrality, and, crucially, truth. We cannot continue the old paradigm. Let's say, like over global warming, where 99.9% of the empirical scientific evidence is given equal play with the tiny minority of deniers. I learned long ago, covering the ethnic cleansing and genocide in Bosnia, never to equate victim with aggressor, never to create a false moral or factual equivalence, because then you are an accomplice to the most unspeakable crimes and consequences. I believe in being truthful, not neutral, and I believe we must stop banalizing the truth." 4. The vanishing of reality. Do I want to interfere with the reality tape? And if so, why? Because, he thought, if I control that, I control reality. Philip K. Dick, The Electric Ant. Surreal and chaos have become two of those words invoked hourly by journalists trying to describe daily reality in America in the second decade of the new millennium, at a time when 19 kids are shot every day in the United States, when the President of the United States plays a game of nuclear chicken with North Korea's Kim Jong-un, when artificial intelligence engines are writing poetry and novellas, when it's getting more and more difficult to tell the difference between headlines from The Onion and headlines from CNN. Trump's unhinged presidency represents some sort of climax in the warping of reality, but the burgeoning disorientation people have been feeling over the disjuncture between what they know to be true and what they are told by politicians, between common sense and the workings of the world, traces back to the 1960s, when society began fragmenting and official narratives, pervaded by the government, by the establishment, by elites, started to break down, and the news cycle started to speed up. In 1961, Philip Roth wrote of American reality, "It stupefies, it sickens, it infuriates." The daily newspapers, he complained, fill one with wonder and awe. Is it possible? Is it happening? And of course, with sickness and despair. The fixes, the scandals, the insanities, the treacheries, the idiocies, the lies, the pieties, the noise. Roth's sense that actuality was exceeding fiction writers' imagination and throwing up real-life figures like Richard Nixon and Roy Cohn, who were the envy of any novelist, would be echoed more than half a century later by writers of satire and spy thrillers in the Trump era. And his observation that novelists were having difficulty dealing imaginatively with a world they felt to be confounding helps explain why journalism, particularly what Tom Wolfe called the new journalism, began eclipsing fiction in capturing what life was like in the 1960s, as the Esquire anthology aptly titled Smiling Through the Apocalypse, featuring classic magazine pieces by such writers as Norman Mailer, Michael Hare, and Gay Talese, attested. Politicians had always spun reality, but television, and later the internet, gave them new platforms on which to prevaricate. When the Republican strategist Lee Atwater observed in the 1980s that perception is reality, he was bluntly articulating an insight about human psychology that Homer well knew when he immortalized Odysseus as a wily trickster, adept at deception and disguise. But Atwater's cold-blooded use of that precept in using wedge issues to advance the GOP's Southern strategy and to create the infamous Willie Horton ad in the 1988 presidential campaign injected mainstream American politics with an alarming strain of win-at-all-costs Machiavellianism using mass media as a delivery system. Nearly three decades later, Trump would cast immigrants in the role of Willie Horton, and turning the clock back further, he would exchange dog-whistle racism for the more overt racism and rhetoric of George Wallace. At the same time, he instinctively grasped that the new internet-driven landscape and voters' growing ignorance about issues made it easier than ever to play to voters' fears and resentments by promoting sticky, viral narratives that served up alternate realities. He also amped up efforts to discredit journalism as fake news, attacking reporters as enemies of the people, a chilling term once used by Lenin and Stalin. It wasn't just that Trump lied reflexively and shamelessly, but that those hundreds upon hundreds of lies came together to create equally false storylines that appealed to people's fears, depicting America as a country reeling from crime, when in fact the crime rate was experiencing historic lows, less than half what it was at its peak in 1991. A country beset by waves of violent immigrants, when, in fact, studies show that immigrants are less likely to commit violent crimes than U.S.-born citizens. Immigrants who are a burden to the country and who should be vetted more carefully, when, in fact, 31 of 78 American Nobel Prizes since 2000 were won by immigrants, and immigrants and their kids have helped found an estimated 60% of the top U.S. tech companies, worth nearly $4 trillion. In short, Trump argued, a nation in deep trouble, and in need of a savior. Long before he entered politics, Trump was using lies as a business tool. He claimed that his flagship building, Trump Tower, is 68 floors high, when in fact it's only 58 floors high. He also pretended to be a PR man named John Barron or John Miller to create a sock puppet who could boast about his, Trump's, achievements. He lied to puff himself up, to generate business under false pretenses, and to play to people's expectations. Everything was purely transactional. All that mattered was making the sale. He spent years as a real estate developer and reality TV star, promiscuously branding himself Trump Hotels, Trump Menswear, Trump Natural Spring Water, Trump University, Trump Steaks, Trump Vodka, Trump Home Collection. And like most successful advertisers and successful propagandists, he understood that the frequent repetition of easy-to-remember and simplistic taglines worked to embed merchandise and his name in potential customers' minds. Decades before handing out MAGA hats at his rallies, he'd become an expert at staging what the historian Daniel Boorstin called pseudo-events. That is, events planned, planted, or incited primarily for the immediate purpose of being reported or reproduced. Boorstin's 1962 book, The Image, which would inform the work of myriad writers from French theorists like Baudrillard and Guy Debord, to social critics like Neil Postman and Douglas Rushkoff, uncannily foresaw reality TV decades before the Kardashians or the Osbournes or any number of desperate housewives actually showed up in our living rooms. For that matter, he anticipated the rise of someone very much like Donald J. Trump, a celebrity known, in Boorstin's words, for his well-knownness, and who would even host a show called The Celebrity Apprentice. Boorstin's descriptions of the 19th-century impresario and circus showman P.T. Barnum, who ran a New York City museum of curiosities filled with hoaxes like a mermaid, which turned out to be the remains of a monkey stitched together with the tail of a fish, will sound uncannily familiar to contemporary readers. A self-proclaimed prince of humbugs, whose great discovery was not how easy it was to deceive the public, but rather how much the public enjoyed being deceived, as long as it was being entertained. Much the way images were replacing ideals, Boorstin wrote in The Image, the idea of credibility was replacing the idea of truth. People were less interested in whether something was a fact than in whether it was convenient that it should be believed. And as verisimilitude replaced truth as a measurement, the socially rewarded art became that of making things seem true. No wonder that the new masters of the universe in the early 1960s were the Mad Men of Madison Avenue. Baudrillard would take such observations further, suggesting that in today's media-centric culture, people have come to prefer the hyper-real, that is, simulated or fabricated realities like Disneyland, to the boring, everyday desert of the real. Artists like Jorge Luis Borges, William Gibson, Stanislaw Vlem, Philip K. Dick, and Federico Fellini grappled with similar themes, creating stories in which the borders between the real and the virtual, the actual and the imagined, the human and the post-human blur, overlap, even collapse. In the story Toulon Ukbar Orbis Tertius, Borges describes a secret society of astronomers, biologists, engineers, metaphysicians, poets, chemists, mathematicians, moralists, painters, and geometricians who invent an unknown planet named Toulon. They conjure its geography, its architecture, its systems of thinking. Bits and pieces of Toulon start surfacing in the real world. An artifact here, a description there, and things speed up around 1942. Eventually, the narrator notes, the teachings of Toulon have spread so widely that the history he learned as a child has been obliterated and replaced by a fictitious past. Borges drew direct parallels between the power of fictions about Toulon to insinuate themselves into human consciousness and the power of deadly political ideologies based on lies to infect entire nations. Both, he suggested, provide internally consistent narratives that appeal to people hungering to make sense of the world. Reality gave ground on more than one point, Borges wrote. The truth is that it hankered to give ground. 10 years ago, any symmetrical system whatsoever, which gave the appearance of order, dialectical materialism, anti-Semitism, Nazism, was enough to fascinate men. Why not fall under the spell of Talon and submit to the minute and vast evidence of an ordered planet? Useless to reply, that reality too is ordered. It may be so, but in accordance with divine laws. I translate, inhuman laws, which we will never completely perceive. Talon may be a labyrinth, but it is a labyrinth plotted by men, a labyrinth destined to be deciphered by men. Thomas Pynchon's novels explore similar themes, more relevant than ever in a world suffering from information overload. Reeling from a kind of spiritual vertigo, his characters wonder whether the paranoiacs have it right, that there are malign conspiracies and hidden agendas connecting all the dots, or whether the nihilists are onto something, that there is no signal in the noise, only chaos and randomness. If there is something comforting, religious, if you want, about paranoia, he wrote in Gravity's Rainbow, there is still also anti-paranoia, where nothing is connected to anything, a condition not many of us can bear for long. In a 2016 documentary titled Hyper-Normalization, the British filmmaker Adam Curtis created an expressionistic, montage-driven meditation on life in the post-truth era. The title, which also seems to allude to Baudrillard, was taken from a term coined by the anthropologist Alexei Yurchak to describe life in the final years of the Soviet Union, when people both understood the absurdity of the propaganda the government had been selling them for decades and had difficulty envisioning any alternative. In Hypernormalization, which was released shortly before the 2016 U.S. election on the BBC's iPlayer platform, Curtis says in voiceover narration that people in the West had also stopped believing the stories politicians had been telling them for years, and Trump realized that, in the face of that, you could play with reality, and in the process, further undermine and weaken the old forms of power. Some Trump allies on the far right also seek to redefine reality on their own terms, invoking the iconography of the movie The Matrix, in which the hero is given a choice between two pills, a red one, representing knowledge and the harsh truths of reality, and a blue one, representing soporific illusion and denial. Members of the alt-right and some aggrieved men's rights groups talk about red-pilling the normies, which means converting people to their cause. In other words, selling their inside-out alternative reality in which white people are suffering from persecution, multiculturalism poses a grave threat, and men have been oppressed by women. Alice Marwick and Rebecca Lewis, the authors of a study on online disinformation, argue that once groups have been red-pilled on one issue, they're likely to be open to other extremist ideas. Online cultures that used to be relatively non-political are beginning to seethe with a racially charged anger. Some sci-fi, fandom, and gaming communities, having accepted run-of-the-mill anti-feminism, are beginning to espouse white nationalist ideas. Ironic Nazi iconography and hateful epithets are becoming serious expressions of anti-Semitism. One of the tactics used by the alt-right to spread its ideas online, Marwick and Lewis argue, is to initially dilute more extreme views as gateway ideas to court a wider audience. Among some groups of young men, they write, it's a surprisingly short leap from rejecting political correctness to blaming women, immigrants, or Muslims for their problems. Many misogynist and white supremacist memes, in addition to a lot of fake news like Pizzagate, originate or gain initial momentum on sites like 4chan and Reddit, before accumulating enough buzz to make the leap to Facebook and Twitter, where they can attract more mainstream attention. Renee DiResta, who studies conspiracy theories on the web, argues that Reddit can be a useful testing ground for bad actors, including foreign governments like Russia, to try out memes or fake stories to see how much traction they get. DiResta warned in the spring of 2016 that the algorithms of social networks, which give people news that's popular and trending rather than accurate or important, are helping to promote conspiracy theories. This sort of fringe content can both affect how people think and seep into public policy debates on matters like vaccines, zoning laws, and water fluoridation. Part of the problem is an asymmetry of passion on social media. While most people won't devote hours to writing posts that reinforce the obvious, DiResta says, passionate truthers and extremists produce copious amounts of content in their commitment to wake up the sheeple. Recommendation engines, she adds, help connect conspiracy theorists with one another to the point that we are long past merely partisan filter bubbles and well into the realm of siloed communities that experience their own reality and operate with their own facts. At this point, she concludes, the internet doesn't just reflect reality anymore. It shapes it. 5. The co-opting of language. Without clear language, there is no standard of truth. John le Carré. Language is to humans, the writer James Carroll once observed, what water is to fish. We swim in language. We think in language. We live in language. This is why Orwell wrote that political chaos is connected with the decay of language, divorcing words from meaning and opening up a chasm between a leader's real and declared aims. This is why America and the world feel so disoriented by the stream of lies issued by the Trump White House and the president's use of language as a tool to disseminate distrust and discord. And this is why authoritarian regimes throughout history have co-opted everyday language in an effort to control not just how people communicate, but also how they think. Exactly the way the Ministry of Truth in Orwell's 1984 aims to deny the existence of external reality and safeguard Big Brother's infallibility. Orwell's newspeak is a fictional language, but it often mirrors and satirizes the wooden language imposed by communist authorities in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. Among the characteristics of wooden language that the French scholar Françoise Thom identified in a 1987 thesis, La Langue de Bois, were abstraction and the avoidance of the concrete. Tautologies. The theories of Marx are true because they are correct. Bad metaphors. The fascist octopus has sung its swan song. And Manichaeanism, that divides the world into things good and things evil, and nothing in between. Mao's Communist Party also adopted a plan of linguistic engineering soon after taking power in China in 1949, creating a new political vocabulary. Some words were suppressed, others were injected with new meanings, and party slogans were drummed into people's brains through constant repetition. People were made to understand that there were correct and incorrect ways to speak, whether it was delivering a work report or engaging in a required round of self-criticism. One of history's most detailed accounts of how totalitarianism affects everyday language was written by Victor Klemperer, a German-Jewish linguist who survived World War II in Dresden. Klemperer kept a remarkable set of diaries chronicling life under Nazi rule in Germany, I Will Bear Witness, and he also wrote a study, The Language of the Third Reich, about how the Nazis used words as tiny doses of arsenic to poison and subvert the German culture from within. The book is a harrowing case study in how the Reich permeated the flesh and blood of the people through idioms and sentence structures that were imposed on them in a million repetitions and taken on board mechanically and unconsciously. It's also a cautionary tale, every bit as unnerving as Orwell's 1984, to other countries and future generations, about how swiftly and insidiously an autocrat can weaponize language to suppress critical thinking, inflame bigotry, and hijack a democracy. Klemperer didn't think Hitler compared with Mussolini as a speaker, and he was surprised that the Nazi leader, whom he saw as an angry, insecure man with an annoying voice and a propensity to bellow, amassed such a following. He attributed Hitler's success less to his heinous ideology than to his skills at going around other politicians to reach out directly to the people. The word Volk was regularly invoked, and Hitler portrayed himself as their voice, their messiah. The big spectacles, effectively pseudo-events that he and Goebbels staged, were a help. The splendor of the banners, parades, garlands, fanfares, and choruses that surrounded Hitler's speeches, Klemperer notes, served as an effective advertising ploy that conflated the Führer with the grandeur of the state. As in the Soviet Union and Maoist China, words underwent a sinister metamorphosis in Nazi Germany. The word fanatisch, fanatical, Klemperer wrote, went from denoting a threatening and repulsive quality associated with bloodlust and cruelty to being an inordinately complimentary epithet, evoking the qualities of devotion and courage needed to fuel the Reich. The word kampferisch, aggressive, belligerent, also became a word of praise, meaning admirable self-assertion through defense or attack. Meanwhile, the word system was scorned because it was associated with the Weimar Republic, which the Nazis despised in much the same way that right-wing Republicans today despise what they call the deep state. Hitler's Mein Kampf was published in 1925, and Klemperer notes that the book literally fixed the essential features of Nazi oratory and prose. In 1933, this language of a clique became the language of the people. It would be as if, say, the argot of the alt-right, its coded use of language to identify fellow travelers, its racial and misogynist slurs, were to be completely mainstreamed and made a part of routine political and social discourse. Klemperer devoted an entire chapter to the Nazis' obsession with numbers and superlatives. Everything had to be the best or the most. If a German from the Third Reich went on an elephant hunt, Klemperer wrote, he would have to boast that he'd finished off the biggest elephants in the world, in unimaginable numbers, with the best weapon on earth. Many of the Nazis' own numbers, regarding enemy soldiers killed, prisoners taken, audience numbers for a radio broadcast of a rally, were so exaggerated that they took on what Klemperer calls a fairy tale quality. In 1942, he writes, Hitler says in the Reichstag that Napoleon fought in Russia in temperatures of minus 25 degrees, but that he, commanding officer Hitler, had fought at minus 45, even at minus 52. All the lying and hyperbole eventually reached the point, Klemperer continues, that it became meaningless and utterly ineffective, finally bringing about a belief in the very opposite of what it intended. Trump's mendacity is so extreme that news organizations have resorted to assembling lengthy lists of lies he's told, insults he's delivered, norms he's violated, in addition to hiring squads of fact-checkers. And his shamelessness has emboldened politicians around him to lie with even more effrontery than ever. Republicans in Congress, for instance, blatantly lied about the effects their tax bill would have on the deficit and social safety net provisions, just as they lied about how much it would help the middle class, when in fact it was all about giving tax breaks to corporations and the very rich. Trump's assault on language is not confined to his torrent of lies, but extends to his taking of words and principles intrinsic to the rule of law and contaminating them with personal agendas and political partisanship. In doing so, he's exchanged the language of democracy and its ideals for the language of autocracy. He demands allegiance not to the U.S. Constitution, but to himself. And he expects members of Congress and the judiciary to applaud his policies and wishes, regardless of what they think best serves the interests of the American people. With other phrases, Trump has performed the disturbing Orwellian trick. War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength. Of using words to mean the exact opposite of what they really mean. It's not just his taking the term fake news, turning it inside out, and using it to try to discredit